Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
One name that comes up constantly in researching early pro football is that of Hap Moran. Hap was a star of four different top-tier franchises in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And his son, Mike Moran, visits the Pigpen to share his dad's fantastic story, coming up in a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome back to the Pigpen. We have our normal Monday show. We're talking about early pro football teams, but we have got such a treat today. We're going to talk about four different early pro football teams, prior to World War II, and it's all centering around one great player from that era. And we have his son here today. The player is Hap Moran, and his son Mike is here today to give us a great biography on his father. Let's bring him in right now. Mike Moran, welcome to the Pigpen.
Oh, thanks, Darren. Glad to be here.
Mike, before we came on the air, you were telling me some stories of how your early experiences of football. And maybe you could just share some of that with us. Tell us how you became a great football fan and historian.
Well, my dad retired from the NFL in 1933. And of course, they had no benefits or pension plan then. But he did get a lifetime pass to any NFL football game, excluding championships. And so as a kid, I grew up in Queens, New York, about 40 minutes on the train from the Polo Grounds. So we would hop on the train and go to the Polo Grounds, and my dad would show the pass. We'd walk through the turnstile, and we'd go sit in the press box, and we watched the game. That he felt that he still knew some of the press guys. So, but I have to admit, as a kid, I wasn't paying much attention. I was looking for the next hot dog or the peanuts or something, But it was a little intimidating because it was all these guys in their fedoras and their dark overcoats, and their typewriters or whatever. And it's kind of a fond memory. And then later when the Giants went to Yankee Stadium, we could go in there. And actually, I met some of the players because on Election Day, which was a holiday in New York City, a couple of times, my dad took me up to practices and we sat around and we watched them practice. Now we went into the clubhouse, and the thing I remember is shaking hands with these guys and coming away like numb up to my elbow. But I got to meet some of them, and I became like, there was the era of Connerly, and but my favorite was Ray Witeka, the center. So always had a soft spot for him. I didn't know, much about the football history at that time. And that really didn't come into play till after my father died. And I got, first thing that happened was I started getting letters from all these people saying, do you have any equipment? Did your father have any equipment? Can we buy anything from you? But then I got one guy who wrote to me, and he was from the Professional Football Researchers Association. And he asked me if I would write an article for their newsletter, which is called The Coffin Corner, and about my father. And I said I would. And I started doing a little research, and I realized really how little I knew. So this was also just when eBay was beginning. So it was like grief counseling, eBay. I got my father's NFL pension and it metastasized into this obsession, really.
Yeah, I guess one big question is, was the going to any NFL game, was that transferable down to you, or was it just
No, non-transferable. I don't know what happened to that pass. You know, that's another thing. I've searched. One of the things I collect is NFL passes, probably because I lost that one. And I haven't found a lifetime pass signed by Joe Carr. And I have a lifetime pass for a guy who was a trainer, Andy Lotshaw, and it's signed by Elmer Layden, one of the Four Horsemen. But I've not found one signed by Joe Carr yet.
And that's probably the one that your father would have been a Joe Carr one.
Yeah, right? Joe Carr was still running the show in 1933.
Wow, that is amazing. Now, you referred to that Coffin Corner article from 1999 that you wrote, and I found it extremely interesting. And by the way, to our listeners, Mike has a great tribute website to his father called hapmoran.org, hapmoran.org. And, you know, it's a wealth of information on the man. My hat's off to you, how much work you put into this. It is really tremendous. But in that Coffin Corner article, you start off by saying that you didn't really know that you're aware your father played football, but you didn't realize what a big deal he was. He was somewhat humble about that and didn't share a lot of that. Is that right?
There was one thing in our house that would make you think my father was a football coach, because after he retired from the Giants and moved out to this apartment house in Queens, there was a park right next door, Sunnyside Park. And the story I heard was, as soon as my father moved in, like 2 days later, some kids knocked on the door and said, "We have a football team. Would you come and coach us?" And so there was an article in a newspaper about him coaching this youth football squad. And there was a drawing that somebody did to accompany the article. And that was what was on the wall. There was nothing about pro football or anywhere. And I didn't really realize, I think I found out when I was in Cub Scouts and someone said something to me, and it was like, what? I mean, I didn't, and also I wouldn't have, I was like, what, seven at that time. I didn't understand what it meant. I had no clue, but no, I think, you know, part of my father's story is that his father was killed when he was seven. His father was a railroad man out in Iowa, and he got run over in a rail yard accident.
Oh my goodness.
And yeah. So my father, I mean, football at least was less dangerous than railroading. But after that, my father had a career as a professional, and he was a buyer for Western Electric, which was the supplier for the entire Bell system. So at one point he was buying all of the telephone poles that the Bell system used in the whole United States, or all of the typewriters, or all of the pencils, pens, canvas safety bags. And when I was growing up, every day, put on a suit and tie and got on the subway, went down to Broadway and the financial district. And, you know, I think he saw football as a step up to a career. And what he had in mind for my brother and me was the career, you know, no calluses, white shirts, that kind of thing. So, yeah, he never talked about it as the good old days. And in fact, he never really talked about it at all. It was, I guess, you know, when he got into the late 80s and 90s, he started telling us more, but yeah, I don't know. It wasn't the defining moment of his life. It was a step on the way to something more prosperity and security and safety and the capacity to raise a family, you know?
Well, that's part of the mystique that makes him so interesting. I mean, his whole story is interesting, but that's just another layer of this story that just makes it real interesting. Now, before we pressed record here, you were telling me, okay, you just talked on air about your dad was coaching a youth team in a neighborhood when you first moved to a place. But you were telling me earlier about your experiences with playing youth football at a younger age. If you could share some of that.
I was not cut out to be a football player, I'll tell you. I remember, I was telling you, I went to this little high school in Manhattan, and we only had a six-man football team, which I think was developed by the Navy or something so they could play football on ships. I'm not sure of the whole story. And if you look at the 1937 Wheaties, they had those Wheaties panels with football players, and then they had some about six-man. They had one or two about six-man football. And the director of athletics thought I must know everything about football. He knew my dad. He'd been a Giants fan. He drove me to football camp. And, you know, we all got in a circle and somebody went in the middle and everybody hit him. And I was in the middle and I thought, no, this is I want nothing to do with this. This is just not for me. I love to swim. And I thought, I think I'll pick a sport where the pain level is entirely in my control, you know. So I swam in high school and I rowed. And my father actually encouraged me to row in college. And I don't know if anybody's read that book, The Boys in the Boat. It's a great book about the crew team from the University of Washington that went and competed in the Olympics in Berlin in whatever year that was, 1936. The ones were Jesse Owens and the Nazis and that whole big story. And Mel Heim was from Washington and was a crew fan. And he used to tell the guys on the Giants that if they thought football was rough, they should try rowing. And I think my father got introduced to it because Mel Heim and he went up to watch those Olympic trials at Poughkeepsie, New York. So my father never set foot in a boat. But when I went to Rutgers, he said to me, you should try rowing. That's a tough sport. I think you might like it, you know. So indirectly from the University of Washington rowing team to Mel Heim, to my father, to me, there was a connection there. So I coached rowing also at Rutgers for a while and always enjoyed it.
Wow. That's I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania. So rowing's quite a big sport around here. Also, we have quite a few competitions at Mercer University here in town, does quite a bit on that. So I'm familiar with that. So that is a tough sport. I've never done it myself, but it looks very strenuous. That's for sure. Now, I guess maybe let's go back, to where you think your father's football career started. You know, was it at the high school level, college level?
Yeah, well, I think where it started was really was on the railroad, because in the summers in high school, he would he worked as a railroad kind of track man, and they would get on these railroad cars and they would go out and repair track, and he would be swinging these 16-pound sledgehammers, you know, for weeks in the summer. And then when he went to high, he went to high school in Boone, Iowa, which is a big railroading town. And I have pictures of him playing football there, but really basketball was his sport. He was an All-American basketball player. In those days, it was considered, I don't know if it was illegal, but it was considered wrong for college coaches to go visit high schools and recruit. So Amos Alonzo Stagg, who was the famous Yale, you know, player and coach, but he was hired by the University of Chicago to build up a football. There's a great book about this called Stagg's University, about the interaction between money, football, alumni. I mean, it goes way back. This is not a new issue. So what he did was he set up these interscholastic tournaments at the University of Chicago so that the best athletes in throughout the Midwest, I don't know how many Eastern schools came to him, and he could see them. And I have some of the track and field and basketball programs from those tournaments, and you see a lot of future great football players in there doing in those sports because there was no football tournaments. So Stagg picked my father as an All-American basketball player, and I think football was kind of secondary. And then he went to Grinnell College for a year, and I think he played on the freshman football and basketball teams, but then he was recruited by Carnegie Tech. And my brother went to Carnegie, which is now Carnegie Mellon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we went to a football game there, and the crowd was less than my daughter's field hockey team got in high school. I mean, football was nothing at Carnegie in the 60s, but in the 20s, I mean, they're scheduled. They played Notre Dame regularly. They were a real powerhouse of football. So he played for them in 1922. And I think it's in the article that I'm sure you read it, but when they played Notre Dame, the Notre Dame Carnegie game of 1922 is the first time the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame were ever on the field together. And that was, and so my father was the halfback for Carnegie against, the Four Horsemen. But he got hurt. He got injured. And they went back to Grinnell, and he played. He had to take a year off. And then he played for 2 years at Grinnell before going into the NFL. But Grinnell was, it's a small school in Iowa, but an interesting note is two of his friends there were a guy named Morgan Taylor, who was the end on the football team and also won the gold medal in the 440 hurdles in the 1924 Olympics.
Wow.
And medaled in the 24 Olympics, the 28 Olympics, and the 32 Olympics in the hurdles. And another friend of his there was a guy named Frank Cooper, who brought a horse onto the campus, took it up into a building, took it up a couple flights, and couldn't get it to go down. And he got thrown out of the school. And he went out to do stunt work in Hollywood, and they said, there's already a Frank Cooper. You got to change your name. So he changed his name to Gary, and he got a bit,
Wow.
So it was like these three guys were there at Grinnell all at the same time. My father, Morgan Taylor, and Gary Cooper.
Wow. That is tremendous.
Yeah, that is a funny little story. But I don't know. I have the letter that his football coach at Grinnell wrote to the coach of the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, recommending him as a player. But I don't know the mechanism of that. I mean, he had some big runs in college. He got listed in the NCAA guide as like they have this thing of great runs from 1869 to 1926. And he's like on the first, maybe he's number 12. I don't know. He had some big run backs that always got, the stories got retold in every biography or, a little blurb they'd write about him.
Right.
And so I got a chance with the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, which was the Philadelphia franchise before the Eagles.
Yeah.
So that was the progress there.
Well, what a tremendous year to go to the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets in 1926, because they had a pretty good season that year.
And I think, I'm not sure if it was 25 or 26 that they brought Guy Chamberlain as their coach. It might have been the year before. But, I mean, a lot of people never heard of Guy Chamberlain, but Guy Chamberlain was like the Bill Belichick of the 20s. He had been on the original Decatur Staleys with Hallis before it was the Bears. He was the coach of the Canton team. He won in the first 10 years of the NFL, I think he won five of the championships. or was involved with five championship teams. So Chamberlain, he pulled it all together in 26, and they won the NFL title that year. But the NFL title back then was determined by your winning percentage. They had no championship playoff game. So it was a little different, and there was no money in, you know, you didn't get a big ring. My father did get a watch, but yeah, they had the best record in the NFL. And the big game was they and the Bears were pretty closely had pretty close percentage numbers when the Bears came to Philadelphia to play them. And they won that game. My father was injured. He was in the game a little bit, but one of the stars of the game was a guy from Gonzaga named Houston Stockton. Who's Stockton? His grandson, John Stockton. You know, so there's a little athleticism in that family, but yeah, they won the NFL championship that year.
Yeah, now I guess if I remember correctly, didn't they? The Frankfurt Yellow Jackets winning the NFL championship, and they had the rival league, the Red Grange original AFL was going on, and the Philadelphia Quakers, which, Frankfurt is just a suburb of Philadelphia, basically. And the Quakers were the champions of the AFL. And they, you know, I think it was in the press and the media, they wanted to have these two teams play to see who was the best in the nation. It didn't come to fruition, but they did end up having an exhibition game, Frankfurt did, against the New York Giants. Is that correct?
No. The Quakers did.
The Quakers did. Okay.
Having a game, and they got whipped solidly. And then the Yellow Jackets had whipped the Giants solidly. So, you know, you never know game to game, but that makes you think they wouldn't have done very well.
Yeah, the old any given Sunday theory applies, right?
Yeah. So, you know, the year before in 1925, maybe the Yellow Jackets didn't want to play them because the Pottsville Maroons had the biggest percentage in 1925, but they got disqualified from winning the championship because they played an exhibition game against the Notre Dame All-Stars in Philadelphia, which violated the territorial rights of the Yellow Jackets, and Joe Carr disqualified them. So that's a bitter pill, which is still being in Pottsville. You know, you don't want to mention that. So maybe they were gun shy after that, or maybe they just want to give the AFL any legitimacy. I mean, it was everything was on a shoestring at that point anyway, you know.
That's true. I mean, you're only the league was only in existence for 6-7 years at that point, so it's understandable.
Yeah.
It wasn't some hard times there. Now, okay, so 1926 he played for the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets. 1927 he went to a different franchise. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he started out 26-27 with the Yellow Jackets, but for an inexplicable reason I've never read a good explanation of it. Although I think there was committee, the Yellow Jackets were a nonprofit team, but they had a committee that ran them, thought they were spending too much money, and they let Guy Chamberlain go. And they got a coach guy named by the name of Charlie Moran. No relationship as far as we know. But Charlie Moran made his day job was he was an umpire, major league umpire, and he got called in to umpire the World Series. So he really didn't get to the Yellow Jackets until partway into the season. His son was doing it, and they were having a terrible season. A lot of turmoil, and eventually, you know, they lost their coach. And but anyway, the story I heard was that Guy Chamberlain had gone to the Chicago Cardinals, and the Cardinals needed somebody who was a solid kicker. And he got my father to come from Yellow Jackets. Like, I think my father played all the games through the end of October in Philadelphia, and then he went to Chicago. And so he finished the season with the Yellow Jackets. And I know in the first game, finished season with the Cardinals, the Cardinals had another kicker named Bub Weller. And I read one newspaper article that said Weller's attempt at the extra point came closer than usual, but still failed. So I don't know why they didn't let my father kick that extra point. But anyway, yeah, so he finished that season with the Cardinals. And that's all I know about it. I've never been able to find a team picture of the Cardinals. It's very hard to to find their home programs. They labored in the shadow of the Bears. I mean, the one notable thing was I like to sort of research my father's teammates, and he was a teammate on the Cardinals with Duke Slater, who was just inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, another great. Iowa player. So, I mean, I feel like it wasn't totally unproductive for him, but.
I know we've got one person that's very much going to be listening to this program, and that's Joe Ziemba, who I'm sure you're aware of, is a great Chicago Cardinals historian. So maybe Joe can have some connections to find that photo that you're looking for.
Yeah, I've written to Joe.
Oh, have you? Okay, okay.
Years ago, yeah, it's a great book he wrote about what's it called, when the grass was green, or when football was football. I forget the name.
When football was football, the story of the Chicago Cardinals.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Yeah, because yeah, certainly
I had gotten,
is.
I bought a Contra. One of the things I bought on eBay, but a connection I made there was a contract for the last game played by the Duluth Eskimos. And it was against the Bears, and it was signed by Ole Haugsgrud, who was the manager of the and eventually the owner of the Duluth Eskimos. And it was all about there was an All-American named Howard Maple, and it was about, you know, you got to show up at the bus station on this day, and you got to have we'll supply you with a football, but bring your own equipment, and for one of the first training camps. So I went to Joe's book and I was trying to figure out, he helped me figure out who Haugsgrud was, if I'm saying it right. I'm not good with Swedish names or Norwegian. And it was just a wealth of information in there. Yeah.
And I better correct my wrong here, because I've been digging as you've been talking for Joe's book. I butchered the name of it, so let me get it right here. When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL by Joe Ziemba. So yeah. Sorry about that, Joe, butchering the name at first there.
You know, the Haugsgrud is interesting story because he sold that franchise back to the NFL with a provision that if there was ever another Minnesota franchise, he could buy a part of it for a set amount of money. So he became an original owner of the Vikings.
Interesting.
He lived long enough to cash that in. Yeah.
Wow, that's
and
a
they
bit
also
history.
A lot of guys. If you read the guys like Ernie Nevers, and they say he really should be in the Hall of Fame, because when Red Grange, as you mentioned, formed a separate league, the NFL was really lacking a marquee star from the college years. And Haugsgrud and Ernie Nevers went to high school together, and Haugsgrud convinced Nevers to come and get into pro football. And so even though, you know, they didn't play any home games, it was a traveling team, the adding Nevers' name to the NFL roster might have been, you know, some people think that's what tipped the balance in favor of the NFL as opposed to the AFL, the original, the Grange Pyle League, yeah.
Now, was Nevers and Ollie with the Cardinals when your dad played, or was that after your dad
left? I think they were with the Eskimos at that point.
Yeah, it must have been like a year or two later, I think.
And then they went over a year later afterwards.
But your father had another team transfer that next season or shortly thereafter.
Yeah, well, next season in 1928, he went to Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and played for those Pottsville Maroons. And, you know, I don't know. I have his contract. That's one thing I do have, his contract from that year. But I don't have any correspondence. I don't know how it came to be that he ended up in Pottsville. It was the only thing my father told me about Pottsville was that the field was like the basis of the field was all this slag coal, because Pottsville was, you know, the anthracite district. It was the anthracite league. It was a tough league. It got out of the anthracite league and got into the NFL. And he said, if you cut yourself on that field, you had to like pour iodine over. It was like bacterially infected. And the other story he told, and I'm not sure if it was from that year or later, but just about those coal mining towns and the intense rivalries that existed, was he got hired to play for some local coal mining town, you know, maybe Shenandoah, Gilberton. I don't know. I don't know the name. He was a ringer. He was brought in as a ringer. And he got there, and like half the players on both teams were NFL players. They all knew each other. They'd all been brought in because there was such heavy betting on these games. And he said they played to a tie. And like they'd never even got their clothes back. They had to like get on directly from the field onto the train. People were going to, you know, strangle them because nobody made any money. They didn't lose any money, but nobody made any money. So that was a pretty tough team and a tough league.
Yeah, and pretty tough crowd. You know, when they say tough crowd, that's a tough crowd.
Hard rock.
Football players off the field.
And I don't know. You know, they had a terrible year. They didn't do well. And they had four future Hall of Famers on that team. They had, let's see if I remember. Well, John Blood McNally was on it.
Right.
Walter Kiesling was on it. Peter Fats Henry. Pete Henry was on it. Maybe those were the only three. I don't remember now if there was a fourth or not. It seemed to me there was. They did not have a good year. Again, I think it was management and coaching, because after that season, the franchise moved to Boston for 1 year and then folded. And they became the Boston Bulldogs, and then they didn't do very well. They folded. But, you know, it was the thing that happened for my father in Pottsville was the story, and I don't have documentation of it. I just kind of remember it, was that in a game against the Giants, he and Steve Owen had a collision, and Steve Owen was knocked unconscious.
Really?
Wow. So, yeah. So at the end of that season, the Pottsville ended their season in 1928 before the Giants. And the Giants had this Yale All-American on their team named Bruce Caldwell. And Bruce Caldwell was a great runner, you know, really good player, but he wouldn't block for anybody. And at one point, the other Giants just stopped blocking for him, and he was just getting clobbered. And, you know, he'd been a marquee player at an Ivy League school, and the Giants released him right before the end of the season, and they brought my father in to take his place. And my father was a good blocker. I know he was not a prima donna. So I got a great picture of him blocking for Friedman. It's just classic. So they brought my father in for the last game, and it was against Red Granger's New York Yankees at Yankee Stadium, and my father scored the touchdown for the Giants that day, and And that's how he got to New York. So being in Pottsville, have you ever had a job that was a terrible job, but it got you your next job? You know, that's...
Yeah, one of those stepping stone jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, let's pause for a second, because you're saying, you know, your father had a collision with Steve Owen, who's, you know, well-known Giants coach, but he was a pretty good sized man in his playing days. And your father, I mean, you look at your website and you're seeing all these things, you know, the longest run from scrimmage in this game, the most receiving yards. And when I first was reading that, I'm sitting there picturing in my mind, you know, somebody like, you know, Christian McCaffrey or something, or some small, fast guy that's playing here. But then I'm looking at some of the film you have on there in his Giants games, which we'll talk about here in a minute, and looked at the size that the Pro Football Reference has him down as. 6'1", 190 pounds was his playing size. Now, that doesn't sound big to us today, but in the 1920s, the average American male was 5'7", 147 pounds. So your dad was a large man, and he had some great athleticism to boot, and a two-way player, actually a three-way player, because he was punting and kicking as well and playing offense and defense. Just a tremendous athlete he had.
Well, yeah, really had no choice then. You know, if you were taken out in the first quarter, you couldn't go back in again till the second quarter. There was no running people in and out, so you had no choice. I mean, everybody played both ways till the late 30s, or, you know, I'm not sure exactly when colleges did it first, but you had no choice but to play both ways back then. And, you know, you couldn't run in. If you ran in somebody who just knew how to punt, I don't think I read all these, who's the greatest of all times, like who's the greatest quarterback of all times, and they're comparing things. And I often wonder, like, if Tom Brady, like, compare him to Benny Friedman on the Giants. When Friedman threw all 1929, set the NFL record for touchdown passes, if you threw a pass into the end zone and it was incomplete, the ball turned over to the other team. Like, that's a basic rule change that makes – and plus you had to play defense. I find these great. You know what I like about sports is you go and you do something. It's at a set time. If it's a football game, it's an hour. If it's a crew race, it's like 8 minutes or whatever. And when it's over, it's done. But sports talk, it's never over. It's never done. So I I'm trying to compare people from the different eras.
You really can't, especially the game of football. Something like baseball you can do, because there's subtle changes, but football has had so many morphic changes, you know, that have really changed the landscape, you know, probably four or five times during the course of the history of the game. It's just amazing. But you can't even compare a quarterback from the 1970s to the quarterback today, because it's a different game altogether. So,
you know, the Giants did not have a very good year in 1928. So Tim Mara, the owner, went and bought an entire franchise, the Detroit Wolverines, so he could get the number one quarterback in the NFL in New York City, Benny Friedman. And a lot of the guys from the Giants in 1928 weren't there in 29. My father was one of the few. But although some of them did pretty well other places, one of the Giants from 1928 was Cal Hubbard, who, you know, went to Green Bay.
Right.
Pretty good.
Yeah, I'd say so. Hall of Famer.
But he, the only man in the Football Hall of Fame and the Baseball Hall of Fame.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I know his granddaughter was working on getting him a stamp, you know, a U.S. postal stamp. I don't know if she's made any luck with it, but anyway, so yeah, he was invited back to New York in 1929. So, and that was a good year for them.
Yeah. He, for the Giants. Now he, you have some great footage on your website. Again, that's hapmoran.org. And, you know, the 1929 game against the Packers, and you also have, I believe, a 1934 game against Portsmouth.
And, 32.
And I believe it was the Portsmouth game, and where, you know, he shows off his great defensive play, and your father comes in, I believe, just like crushes Dutch Clark, I believe.
But the 29 game was, again, they went by percentages. That was effectively the championship playoff game in 29. And the Packers won, and they won the championship by like 4%, no, 2%, maybe 0.2% of percentage point. I don't know what it was. And, yeah, that was a great game for the Packers.
I, you know, before I forget, I've got to ask this question. This is like the $100 question here. Where did your father get the nickname Hap from?
There was a cartoon character named Happy Hooligan. And that is my understanding of where he got the nickname. And I think it might have had to do something with being sent to get a bucket of beer. I'm not sure about that part. yeah, there was a Happy Hooligan. And so my grandmother would really, his middle name was Dale, which I don't even know how he spelled it. I mean, I spelled it more than one way, D-A-Y-L-E or D-A-L-E. She called him Dale or Happy. And yeah, occasionally in the programs, he's listed as Happy, not Hap. But Hap was what he used as an adult, anyway, that I know of. I never heard anybody call him Frank.
Very interesting.
His first name was Francis. So,
yeah, I had to make sure I asked that question because that's the one that popped up to me right away. So,
well, you look up Happy Hooligan, you'll see he was a very funny little guy.
Oh, I have to. I'll make sure I have to. Okay, so tell me a little bit about him with the Giants, because that's where he spent the most of his NFL career, six seasons, I believe, with the New York Giants.
Yeah, so the Giants had a I'm in touch with the great-grandson of Dr. Harry March. And Dr. Harry March was from Canton, Ohio, and had been the team, always loved football, might have played football in college a little bit, and was kind of the team doctor for the Canton Bulldogs when Thorpe was playing. And he ended up, he was also a theatrical man and a medical doctor. And he ended up in New York City, and Joe Carr wanted to find a buyer, wanted to find a New Yorker who could finance and manage an NFL franchise in New York City. There had been a Giants in New York City in like 1922-23 called Brickley's Giants, which Charles Brickley was a famous Harvard All-American, that had failed. So they hadn't been able to get a good franchise in New York City. And you know, I was reading an interesting thing by Dutch Clark, speaking of Dutch Clark the other day. He said the same thing was true in Detroit. There were so many great college teams in Detroit that it was hard for the NFL to get a foothold there. And there were a lot of great college football teams in New York City. So it was hard for the NFL to get a football team there. And Tim Mara was a bookmaker and was trying to get a piece of, I think, Gene Tunney, or a boxer. And he was having no luck with it, and Harry March knew him, and he took Joe Carr to his office and said, look, you, I'm sorry, you can't get this boxer you want, but here's an opportunity for what, $500. You can have a NFL franchise. And the story is that Tim Mara had never even seen a football game. He was like into the horses and into boxing. But he said, look, an empty storefront in New York City is worth $500. I'll take it. But to Dr. March, he said, you got to run it. I'm not running it. So March was the man, and I think he was a part owner originally. He was the man who did all the recruiting for the Giants for like the first maybe 7 years of their existence until Tim Mara's son, Jack Mara, got out of school and came on board as like the vice president of the club. And so Dr. March was the one who got my father in, and my father even lived with Dr. March and a couple other Giants in this in his like rooming house somewhere, and we're largely the result of this Dr. March's initiative. And I'm so glad I'm in touch with the grandson, because you ever heard of Doc March? No, probably not.
No.
90%. He's very important in the history of the NFL, and nobody's heard of him. And the grandson is writing a book about it. So
wow,
hopefully that's... his name will become better known.
Yeah, I think you'll have to give me his contact information if you can. Just when you get his book,
I'd
love to get him on. And that sounds like a very interesting story. So, but you know, you brought up quite another question I had, and you sort of somewhat answered it here. Now, your father, you know, went to four different teams, and matter of fact, in the first, you know, 15 years of the NFL and APFA, these are four of the biggest franchises going. You know, they all competed for championships in that era. And but how was it for a player in that era to transfer to a different city, especially, you know, he's going from, you know, Chicago to, you know, Frankfurt, to, you know, Philadelphia area to New York.
The Yellow Jackets, it was really an athletic club, athletic association, and they had a golf course. And so they were in a bowling alley, I believe, or all I know is that my father worked. They also provided work for him at the golf course and at the bowling alley. And I would assume, I don't know about where they lived in Frankfurt and Philly, but when he went to Pottsville, they all stayed in a hotel. There was the Necco Allen Hotel in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and that was where the players lived. And I know when he went to New York City, he lived with this Dr. March for a while. And then they also lived in a hotel, the Hotel Paris. And my father, basically lived out of a suitcase for a lot of his life. He used to stay, when he was on the railroads, they'd stay in YMCAs or things like this. I mean, it was not, he never owned a home his entire life. He was like, he lived in hotels and it was an apartment guy. So I think a lot of the guys from the Giants did live in this Hotel Paris in Manhattan. And in fact, there's a guy named Jack Cavanaugh who wrote a book about the 1958 Giants. And I think anybody who didn't live in New York City, a lot of those Giants all still lived in a hotel, because he talks about after games, they would, they'd go to different floors and then they'd all get on the subway and go into Manhattan out to, like Toots Shores or something. Andy Robustelli take the train home to Stamford, Connecticut, but I don't think it was I think it was a nomadic life. Let's put it that way at that time.
I'm sure it probably was. Well, Mike, I appreciate you coming on and spending some time and sharing this great story of your father. And I want to share with the listeners once again, if you want to learn more about Hap Moran, Mike's website, hapmoran.org. We'll have a link for it in our show notes for this podcast. We'll also have it on pigskindispatch.com. So you can go and enjoy this great website and enjoy the videos and all the other articles are on there. It's really tremendous.
You got time for one more story?
Oh, absolutely. Please do.
So this guy, Harry March, he bought a refitted submarine chaser from World War One. And I have no idea why. And then there was articles in the newspaper that the Giants are going a la Huck Finn down the Mississippi River with this boat, with a Harry Marchone. And they took it down the Mississippi and into Miami, and they put it into the hands of a captain, a real guy, and they left. And the captain stole the boat. And then my father, the owners, asked my father to go down to Miami and investigate, where's our boat? So my father went down there, and he found out that it was called the Kingfisher, that the captain was part of this international scheme to smuggle Chinese out of Mexico into the United States. And the whole thing unraveled because this woman aviator crashed her plane, which was loaded with gold. And anyway, my father's remembrance of this was how seasick he got trying to get to Cuba, where the boat was. And a guy ended up in jail. And that was my father's last seamanship thing. And then like 20 years later, this guy shows up on the TV show, like What's My Line or the 64, one of these quiz shows, as an expert on Navy, on merchant marine stuff. And then my father runs into him on the street near where we lived. And we lived in Sunnyside. Jackson Heights is where you went and did your shopping. And my father said, I just looked at him. I said, hello, Captain. And he said, the guy just turned and ran the other way. But that's a story that he's not a kid. He's the grandson, great grandson of Harry March. He's been doing a lot of research into this crazy story that involved the giant New York Giants and gold and the illegal immigrants.
Oh my God. My head's spinning, my jaw's on the ground. That story had a lot of pieces moving there.
Yeah. Well, I'm
airplanes sure I filled with gold crashing and Chinese immigrants from Mexico and the New York Giants. Wow.
Yeah, there you go. 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, my goodness. My goodness gracious. Well, sir, I really appreciate your time in sharing your family story. He is a truly an integral part of football history. And we are sure glad that we were able to have you on and share this great story with them. And please continue your great work with your website and spreading the great story of Hap Moran to the world, because it is truly remarkable. And we appreciate your time.
All right, Darren. Thank you.
Hey, are you ready for some football? Some fantasy football? How about some daily fantasy football? Silly questions, right? Of course you are. You're ready to talk some smack and win some cash every Sunday and Thursday and Monday and whenever there's football games. The Sports History Network invites you to play your daily fantasy football this season at ThriveFantasy.com. Thrive Fantasy offers hundreds of thousands, millions in cash every day on NBA, MLB, PGA, golf, cricket, esports, and of course, NFL football. Every week during the 2021 NFL season, Thrive Fantasy has pool play contests and heads-up matches with prizes of all sizes, and even free play contests for real money. Sign up with Thrive Fantasy today to get a 100% match bonus on your first deposit for up to $100 in free daily fantasy football play. Visit sportshistorynetwork.com/thrive. That's THRIVE. Or enter promo code SHN when depositing at the cashier. Join Thrive Fantasy today, earn cash prizes, and support great shows like this at the Sports History Network. Now that's a win-win-win situation for you to kick off your own NFL season.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's 4th and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that, Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcast. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.